It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
To make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake at the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day and welcome to ANU's Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute at ANU and the School of Politics and International Relations. Now, among the many things that come out of ANU is regular research data from the Centre for Social Research and Methods. In the last few days, the CSRM, as we call it, has produced a report called Hangovers and Hard Landings, Financial Wellbeing and the Impact of COVID-19 and the Inflationary Crises, or the Inflationary Crisis. One of its authors, Professor Nick Biddle, is with me in the studio. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage.
Good to be back.
Always good to talk to you. Also with me is Dr. Intifar Chowdhury. She's also with CSRM, and I think it's fair to say, Inti, that you're a youth researcher.
Yes, absolutely, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And not your first time on Democracy Sausage, either,
if
I could actually say.
Maybe second or third time. We're not sure yet.
Yeah, right. We're not good with numbers.
No, we're not good with numbers.
Nick, let's begin, if we can, by if you could just sort of outline what this report is, in sketch out what it is and I guess how you've gathered this data.
Yeah, so one of the kind of previous experiences on Democracy Sausage was talking about the COVID-19 impact and how that's kind of affected people's well-being, their financial outcomes. So what we did at kind of the start of the pandemic was we interviewed about a little over 3,000 Australians. We thought it'd be a very short pandemic. We'd do a couple of surveys, we'd be done and we'd get on with the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
We're obviously wrong. So what we've been doing is tracking a representative sample of Australians from just prior to the pandemic through the first couple of years. And then we've continued to track those individuals kind of post, I guess, to the extent which we are post-pandemic and into, I guess, what is more of an economic kind of crisis or at least an inflationary crisis. So in August 2023, we ran the most recent kind of wave of data collection. We had a little under 4,500 Australians ask them a range of questions, including their attitudes to democracy and attitudes towards a range of questions, but also tracking their well-being outcomes. So what we have is about 16 or 17 waves of data, depending on the measure which we're using, across a 3.5-year period, where we can really see how the pandemic impacted on people's outcomes, how different economic conditions impacted on people's outcomes, and how it's kind of affecting people's subjective well-being, their views on their own lives, their views on the country, the views on the government, and how that kind of varies across the population as well. So as you mentioned, Inti's done a lot of work on kind of how political attitudes and other attitudes vary across kind of age cohorts and generations. We also look at how it varies by education levels, by region, all those things to really get a picture of how people have been tracking through time.
Yeah, so let's just sort of be pretty clear about this because it's a difference in methodology from the kinds of polls that a lot of people would read from time to time in the major mastheads, news poll and the Resolve political monitor that comes out in what used to be the Fairfax Papers. Yeah. This is different. This is the same, essentially the same cohort.
Yeah. So we do have kind of replenishment of the cohort. So people drop out. People get sick of doing surveys, and so we do make sure that we top up the sample as we're going. What we're really focused on is we try and get kind of a best estimate possible for a particular point in time.
And that's important. And you're interested in tracking.
Exactly. Yeah. We're really interested in tracking not only in the aggregate, but also at the individual level, people's outcomes. So you can use kind of repeated cross sections to see how Australia looks and how it tracks through time. And that's kind of what NewsPoll does. You know, at each point in time, how would people vote? And then another point in time, how would a different set of people vote? And that's really interesting. It's important. But what we're really doing is saying, okay, for this person, have they switched from voting for Labor compared to the coalition? Has this individual, has their outcomes gotten worse? And we think that that adds something different.
Yeah, it does.
And it allows us to answer questions which the standard polling doesn't really allow.
Yeah, so the standard polling works on randomized groups. I mean, exactly. They weight them to make sure they have a representative sample and geographically and demographically by age cohort and so forth. So weighting is important, but they essentially are doing randomized surveys and from that extrapolating a nationwide result.
Yeah, so they get a new sample every time.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
So and that can have benefits because as I mentioned, some people, you know, they get sick of doing surveys, so they drop out. And that's not random. So that's people who drop out are different to those who stay, and we do as best we can to, you know, replace those with a like for like and to kind of adjust as best we can. But they don't allow kind of individual level tracking. So it sometimes you can get this picture of kind of stability. Like if you look at NewsPoll, it looks like, you know, Labor's, you know, it fluctuates a little bit, but it looks like, you know, 52, 48, 57, 43, or whatever whatever adds up to 100.
53, 47,
whatever. And it looks like things are quite stable, but really, like every time we do a survey, about 20% of people change their votes. That's just within a 2 or 3 month period. And those who change their votes are different. And
perhaps do it for different reasons, not all for the same reason, all in the same direction.
Exactly. And kind of when you just have repeated cross sections, you kind of miss those dynamics. And also I think people's kind of individual level trajectories can tell you something about their decision making. It might be voting and might be attitudes towards a particular policy issue. So if you know someone has had a negative experience in the past, or say if you know what their attitudes towards vaccines were in the early 2020s, then that might predict their voting behavior 2 or 3 years down the track. And you can ask them, but, you know, to be honest, do you remember what your attitudes were towards issues 2 or 3 years ago?
Well, I certainly do about vaccines. Certainly, I was absolutely for them.
Sure. And some people, you know, you can kind of have reasonable recall if your views are stable, but yeah, you know, it's hard to remember. Like and it's even hard to remember things like how many hours you worked in a particular week, or, you know, what your income was at a particular point in time. Some people's lives are more stable, others it's a bit more contingent. So I don't know if when you kind of go to apply for a passport or something where you're asked to list your residences over the last few years or the countries you've traveled to, and you think, oh, that's easy to remember. And it's actually really hard to kind of
really
reconstruct
hard.
Your life.
Yeah.
And that's
I remember
why,
going into Russia one time many years ago for when the PM was traveling there, and you had to list all of the countries you'd been to in the last 10 years, which – In because of my line of work was a lot, and you know, so it took a long time, sort of trying to go through the passport and read these faded stamps that have sometimes been smudged as they've been put on, and they just put on randomly through the thing.
And you think you're
I suspect they had no way of checking, and you could have written down anything, but
that's exactly
you kind
right.
of do it conscientiously.
Yeah, like if you think, well, if they know then why are they asking? And if they don't know, it doesn't matter if I'm correct. But there's probably some in between where they do know and they want to make sure that you're telling the truth, but especially if you're going to Russia.
You just don't want to fall foul of that kind of officialdom. It's not noted for its tolerance or goodwill at its heart. Look, just before we go to Inti, just on sort of one of the most sort of fundamental findings, and I suppose this is no great surprise given the discourse we have, given the other polling data we have and the way it reflects in our politics and given our own lived experience, and that is somewhere approaching about a third of respondents, and assuming that's reflective of the country, about a third of Australians, adult Australians, are either having a difficult time or a very difficult time as a result of the economic circumstance at the moment. That's the finding, isn't it? Just a bit over 30%.
Yeah. So, in August, it was a little over 30%. In April, it was a little bit higher than that. But in general, this year, around about a third of Australians were finding it difficult or very difficult on their current income. And you think, how does that... It's often hard to kind of contextualize what that means. So what we're able to do is say, okay, well, pre-COVID it was about a quarter, a little over 26%. So compared to kind of the pandemic, people are more financially stressed now. And you think, okay, well, what about in the early stages of the pandemic when businesses were closing, hours were being cut? Well, actually, we found that there was substantially lower financial stress kind of in the early stages of the pandemic. And that's partly because people had less to spend their money on, but it was also because the government, at least in the first year, provided a lot of financial support, particularly for those at the lower end of the income distribution.
This is a really interesting point because I remember covering this, the GFC back in 2008, 2009, and the lived experience for a lot of people, even though it was called the global financial crisis, at least that's what it was called in Australia, it was called the Great Recession. In the Northern Hemisphere, generally speaking. But in Australia, because of our particular, sort of relationship with China and the booming Chinese economy, and because of some very progressive thinking by the government to protect the economy from recessionary forces, the lived experience for a lot of people was actually that they were better off.
Yep.
Yeah.
There was cash being given to them, and there was all kinds of investment going in to stimulate the economy, the school halls program, and a range of other things. And for the most part, because we didn't have recession, a lot of people were better off. And I think it's probably also true, as you say, with the pandemic in those early months and year and a half of it, I suppose, you're talking about, doubling the dole for some of that time. So Job Seeker's worth twice what it was.
Mm.
JobKeeper was, of course, untold billions just tipped into the economy, not with a great deal of accountability about it, as we now know. But and as you say, I mean, it's like you couldn't travel into it, could you? So you weren't spending your money on overseas holidays or whatever. In fact, you couldn't basically do much at all. You didn't even have to go to work for the most part. You were working from home, and so even your travel costs were down.
Yeah. So this is for during the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was having a fantastic time. Didn't have to spend. I actually ended up saving more.
Yeah.
And I came out of the pandemic more economically happy.
Yeah. In a sounder position.
Than before. Now it's a different story altogether. Mm. So I could resonate with Nick's next report.
Yeah. Are you surprised at all about that finding of around a third of people doing it tough now, though? Because I suppose we're talking about these two things, the pandemic and this post-pandemic period.
Yeah.
The inflation crisis, as I suppose we'd call it, which has been responded to with high interest rates and the hardships that has brought. But we're talking about them as two separate things. But in a way, there's a cumulative impact, both psychologically, which we can come to, but also just that in some ways they're not really separated for a lot of people, are they? If you're on the periphery of the housing market, renting or trying to buy or doing both.
I mean, there obviously are a number of factors and individual cases. Cases are different based on individuals, but I wasn't surprised with Nick's findings from the August ANU poll, and also from my own lived experiences and that of my peers and stuff that I'm seeing around. It has been difficult in the post-pandemic world because of a number of reasons. Obviously, rates rising, you've got inflation, and then you've also at the same time the energy crisis in Europe has had a great impact in Australia. I do remember about a year ago there was petrol prices were all crazy, but now we're kind of like, oh, this is the norm. It's high petrol prices is the norm, but also like everyday life stuff, you know, buying a kilo of broccoli is more expensive than it used to be just last year. So I think Australians are feeling the pinch. I wasn't surprised, actually. I would have thought it would be more.
But well, you had to take out a loan to get a lettuce at one stage.
Or potatoes. And that's the thing. There's been a number of kind of individual items which have, you know, really increased in prices. And it's, you know, obviously some people, their wages have kept up, but for a number of people who are on more fixed incomes or whose kind of income hasn't increased at the same rate, then, yeah, those price increases, you know, make it really hard. And I think it's interesting, kind of, you mentioned petrol. There's certain kind of expenditure which is you know, really salient and also really hard to avoid.
They're not discretionary costs, no. Particularly the further you live from the centre of the city, where you work, particularly if you don't work in the centre of the city and you have to go cross suburban, or if you're in the regional areas or whatever. I mean, having your own transport is a fixed cost, right? A fixed and unavoidable cost.
Absolutely.
And people are really feeling that. Inti, one of the other things that I found interesting from the report was that the hardest circumstance, or the cohort reporting the hardest circumstances, is the 35 to 54-year-olds, but fairly closely followed by people under 35.
Yeah.
I suppose that's not really surprising, is it? Because in a lot of cases, that 35 to 54-year-old group is going to contain a lot of people who are renting, a lot of people who are trying to enter the housing market or who have just entered the housing market and whose toehold there is precarious.
Yeah.
And under 35s, even more so in both of those categories, in both those senses.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised that younger Australians are or will be bearing the brunt of this inflationary crisis and rates rise in prices and stuff. It's again, as you mentioned, Mark, over 35 are people who are trying to get into the housing market, and we know that it's a different story altogether, the housing affordability crisis, the renting crisis. Under 35s are renting, but also grappling with issues like not having a permanent job. With the casualization of the labor market, I think that's the generation that's really in a precarious position with not having a permanent position, not having working in multiple casual jobs. In some cases, people are staying back at home longer than they used to. And because of that...
As in staying with their parents, you mean?
Staying with their parents. Or boomeranging back to parental homes because of the housing crisis.
Yeah.
I would go as far to say that there are more under 35s who think that home ownership is out of reach completely. And they're grappling with rental increase, which is, it just keeps on rising, and it's difficult. And then on the other hand, you've got people who do get a sort of a foot in the door and start to more, you know, myself, for example, I bought my first apartment and I thought life would be easier. I wouldn't have to rent anymore and I can just be like, whew, it's over now. But with the mortgage came a fresh set of, you know, just looking at RBA and RBA going
a fresh set of anxieties.
A fresh set of anxieties there, because you never know. Every time I get a letter from the bank saying there is a message, I think my heart skips a beat. I just go like, no, I'm not ready for this.
Yeah. Those letters never, very rarely say anything.
They're
good.
They're not good news, no.
No.
But then you can just never win, right? It's either you're a renter or you're mortgaging. You can't, I don't know, I just get this, I'll start whinging now.
But no, whinging's fine. I think there's the very legitimate whinge to be had here.
Yeah, and I think about how, and we joke over at, in the center, me and my colleagues, we joke about how six figures isn't cutting it. Mm-hmm. And we think about the average Australian where they're earning somewhere around 65 to 70,000. How difficult must it be for them? Right? And I think we can sympathize there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some harsh realities. They don't, as we all well know, they don't hit equally, or people, they're differential effects. Let's take a very quick break and come back and continue our discussion.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. You're on Democracy Sausage. I'm talking with Nick Biddle and Intifa Chowdhury. Nick, just before the break, Inti was talking about those age groups, the 35 to 54s and the under 35s, and what your data points to there.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that the dynamics are a little bit different to the kind of the levels. So kind of Inti talked about kind of renters and home and those on a mortgage. And in our data, we certainly find that those who are renting are the most likely to say they've kind of finding it difficult in the current income. Not surprisingly, if you own your own house outright, you're doing pretty well. Mm. And in some ways, kind of higher interest rates can help with bigger returns on savings.
Yeah.
But the largest increase in financial stress has been amongst mortgage holders. So there's been kind of a bit of a convergence between those who have a mortgage and get that letter in the post or in the email from their bank, and then those who are renting. So it's really
this is the double whammy of economic orthodoxy, isn't it? Essentially, because what's happening here, right, is that inflation needs to be tamed. Mm. That is high prices. So those people are like everyone else; they're buying groceries, they're filling the car up, all those things. So they're paying higher prices, and because that inflation is a problem for the economy, the answer is to jack up interest rates, which is their other big fixed cost to try and bring down those costs. So if you're a mortgage holder in that sense, now that doesn't mean that if you're a renter, you're insulated from that because your rent may go up as well.
Yeah, exactly. So those who are kind of landlords will pass on the increase onto renters.
If they can.
If they can, sure. And I think also, I mean, one of the things I guess about renters is for a proportion, it's not just kind of paying your current living costs. There's a number of people who are obviously trying to save for a deposit on a house. And that can be kind of double-edged sword as well. So if interest rates go up, then your savings do increase a little bit as well. But I think that's far outweighed by the need to try and put away some money while you're paying for kind of extra on broccoli or potatoes or whatever the case may be that week.
Yeah. What about, you mentioned there about people who, for example, own their own house outright. It brought to mind another group, which is the people who are, in these cases, this may be these people in some cases, superannuants, people who have significant nest eggs from a life of working and saving there. They've probably done well by virtue of returns in their funds, but then there are others in the groups we've just been talking about who might have been tempted to draw on their superannuation to get through this hard period. Do you have findings there?
Yeah, so on both, we certainly do see some evidence for that. We certainly find that those who have substantial savings, low interest rates are bad for that group, and high interest rates can. Leaving aside the inflation, but the direct effect of interest rate rises can be beneficial for a number of people. But we do find that there's a number of financial actions which people kind of have been taken to kind of manage the financial crisis. One of the things we've been able to do is kind of track how these things have varied over the pandemic period. So early on in the pandemic, there was a lot of people who drew down on super, and that was because of a change in the rules, and you can go into debates about whether that was an effective policy or not. But over the last at least 6 months or so, there's been a slight increase in the number of people who are drawing down in their super compared to kind of early in the year. Well, early in the pandemic, so in the first year, there was a little over 13.5% of people kind of draw down on their super. That then declined into early 2023, looking back over the 12 months leading up to that. And then there was a slight increase again from 5.9 to 7.2, as you mentioned. And while that's not large, it certainly is an indication that there is a proportion of people who are needing to draw extra funds. But actually the biggest kind of steps, or the most common steps which people have taken is you know, spending less on essential items. Mm. So we found that a little under 60%, so 57% of people said that they spent less on groceries and essential items in the previous 12 months than they had before. And when you think about it, that's like a very large proportion of people who are looking for ways to, you know, to spend less in order to kind of cover the declines in real income. And this is not kind of luxury items. This is people saying they've spent less on groceries and essential items. There's kind of limits to what you can do that.
There would be. I mean, they're essential items. That's what essential means.
Yeah, and certainly people can find ways to smooth their income for a short period of time. And I guess that's one of the reasons why the RBA has gone, you know, reasonably hard in terms of kind of interest rate rises is that if you can bring inflation down quickly, then people are able to, you know, draw down on savings, smooth their income, smooth their consumption a little bit. It's when kind of inflation takes hold and when it becomes kind of a baked into people's decisions, when it becomes much harder for people to manage.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The Reserve Bank's meeting, I think, today as we record this, at least theoretically, could be going further with interest rates, although there seems to be a consensus that that won't be the case. Mm. And that's because there's been some pretty encouraging news on the inflation front in terms of the fall in the rate of growth of prices. So perhaps the orthodoxy is working. But all of those things, indeed, that Nick's just been talking about, I mean, that's the object of high interest rate policy, is to essentially – take demand out of the economy to lower consumption, to therefore have people deciding, making decisions about how much they spend, so that they so that the inflationary pressure comes down. But of course, you know, in the micro, that's hard for people, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely hard. I can't help but quote a friend who says, "Man, austerity measures. I had to go down from 4-ply toilet rolls to 2-ply toilet rolls," and I can totally relate with what Nick finds in this report. Nick, I can't help but question, in terms of financial steps that people are taking, what about refinancing mortgages or negotiating, I don't know, utility bills, etc.? What do you find in your...
Yeah, so it's interesting because it is, I mean, one of the policy goals of both the current government and the previous government has been to make it easier for people to switch banks, to switch kind of telecommunications companies. And we do see some evidence for that. So we see there's quite a large increase in the proportion of people who are able to renegotiate their bills, a large-ish increase in the proportion of people who could renegotiate kind of the mortgage. But it's not easy. I think one of the challenges in the Australian economy is that there are often only a couple of kind of suppliers of goods and services. So it's hard to renegotiate if there's not competition. So if one arm of government, so the RBA, is kind of increasing interest rates, trying to dampen down demand, then I think a complementary part of that is for government to help support kind of people to kind of make those changes and make those choices. And it's still hard, but we do see in our data that about one in five people were able to renegotiate bills. That's a in some ways it's a negative because it's kind of indication of that, you know, that's one of the last things you do, I guess. But it is a positive in that people are able to kind of shop around and maybe kind of have a little bit of consumer power. And the more consumer power I think people have, the less likely some of these blunter instruments are to have kind of real kind of devastating effects on people.
Yeah,
that's a sort of a cash flow issue in a way, isn't it? That people might be able to take some measures to reduce the immediate call on their limited financial resources, and perhaps later on be able to handle those more effectively. And we had a lot of talk about that in the particularly during the pandemic, of banks saying, you know, if you're struggling, talk to us. And since then, in this high interest rate environment, talk to us and we'll see what we can do. I've always been vaguely cynical about that, I must say. I mean, I think, you know, there are things people can do, and there are things people can do with their energy bills and the like. But, you know, at core, these are just some very high prices, and they're fixed costs for people. And for the most part, they're going to be, you know, either costs they have to carry down the track or sort of relatively marginal gains.
And you also, I think, need to remember that some people have much more power and much more a kind of ability to negotiate those things. So if someone's kind of got a very large mortgage with a bank and has a very high income, then the bank's going to see what they can do to accommodate someone who's able to negotiate the system reasonably well, able to jump online, use the comparisons, and they're able, I think, better able to make those adjustments. The challenge is that there's others who don't necessarily have the same kind of bargaining position in with regards to kind of businesses, and also I think just not the confidence or the ability to work within what is a really tricky and challenging kind of financial
system. And it's an important thing to say. It's an important point to make, I think, because too often there's this kind of underlying assumption, doesn't get stated, but this underlying assumption that we're all equal in these sorts of things. But people who are in disempowered situations, who have always been on the sort of receiving end of, you know, banks and utility companies and the like, you know, tending to live hand to mouth, week to week, may not in all cases, in many cases, feel like they've got the kind of wherewithal to, you know, to make these adjustments to take them on, and they may not have an afternoon to sit on a phone line as
or
well.
They may not know that that's something that can be done. Yeah. And think about a family with 3 or 4 kids, and they don't have the time for a job.
Yeah.
How are you going to set out 1 hour to be like on the phone with, I don't know, Energy Australia, trying to get 15% off? That's going to, I don't know, save you like 3 coffees.
I mean, it's not an insignificant amount in some cases, but you're right. It's an easier thing to talk about in principle than it might be for people to do in practice in many circumstances, particularly if they don't have Wi-Fi and these kinds of things, access to the internet, and in ways that are sort of broadly regarded as essential nowadays to function in the economy.
Mm.
What about, Nick, the sort of psychological aspects of the way these two bookends of crisis, in a sense, the pandemic and then the high interest rate, high inflation environment, have operated, essentially one running into the other? How much of the sort of psychological stress are you able to measure here, and how much of it is, in a sense, cumulative?
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. So there's someone's, you know, previous experience is going to impact how they're affected by kind of contemporary circumstances. So there's a kind of couple of interesting dynamics when it comes to, I guess, broadly mental health and well-being during the pandemic. One is that older Australians have and still have kind of lower levels of psychological distress now than prior to the pandemic. And that gap was even larger early on. So it has, from a kind of mental health perspective, it has had a very different effect across the age distribution. So we found in our data early on in the pandemic, younger Australians, particularly those younger adults aged 18 to 24, not only started off with higher levels of psychological distress, but also had a greater deterioration. There was some convergence through time, but once again, as we've kind of moved from a kind of lockdown restriction type impact to a economic impact, it has once again kind of impacted on younger Australians more than others, partly because of, as Inti was talking about, because of there has been a larger financial hit, but also I think because there is that cumulative experience, Mark, as you mentioned, of if you've kind of gone through you've got early on in the pandemic, the standard things which young adults do, they travel, they go to university, they start meeting new colleagues in face-to-face work. That hasn't occurred. And so they haven't had the opportunity to build up some of those social networks or some of those support structures which might help manage what's now an economic kind of impact.
Yeah, there has been a delayed transition to adulthood for people who are leaving school as well during the pandemic, and also people who are trying to find their first job during the pandemic. So that kind of delayed their entire trajectory, which I'm sure adds, Nick, to the psychological distress or the ongoing distress from the pandemic to now to an inflationary period or grappling with rates rises and cost of living crisis.
And what about the sort of how this plays into now, just in the sort of final part of our discussion, how this plays into political dynamics with which we are all aware? I mean, the country is currently in the throes of officially the campaign for this voice referendum. It feels like there's a lot of rancor and division around. Some of it is the leveraging of these cost of living pressures and anxieties around precarious work and everything else against this notionally symbolic thing. So we've had members of the opposition, lots in the conservative commentariat, talking about the government needing to focus on cost of living, not on this question of resolving First Nations the relationship and reaching a new accommodation. Are you seeing in the data anything that accords with that, sort of adds to that? Because I suppose there's a fairly high level of people who are not happy, broadly speaking, with the direction of the country, which is the kind of thing you often hear said in American politics.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. So we certainly find that those who, at the individual level, have kind of experienced psychological stress there, certainly more like there's a kind of anti-incumbency impact. So prior to the last election, during COVID, people who'd experienced kind of financial stress, that's one of the groups or the main group which kind of the coalition lost its support for. And then since the election, that's kind of translating more obviously to views on the Labor Party. And we certainly do see in our data that argument around focusing on cost of living it appears to be kind of playing out in terms of people's views on a range of issues: confidence in government, voting intention, satisfaction with direction of the country, and also around the voice as well. So there is a sense that people who are struggling are less likely to be kind of supportive of policies or movements or social movements, I guess, which are
abstract.
Yeah, are less directly related. And you can understand that. I mean, it kind of makes sense. But at the same time, I think as you kind of alluded to in your question, government's pretty big and pretty, there's a lot of people there. They can do multiple things.
That's why you have a cabinet rather than just one person.
Yeah, and you have a prime minister. And your Minister for Indigenous Affairs. So it's not like there's no evidence at all, of course, that there's any conflict between a kind of a voice to Parliament and kind of economic policy, and actually to quite
the opposite, actually.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. Yeah. And certainly we've shown in other work that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians are most impacted by a kind of financial impact. So we saw during the global financial crisis that prior to that there was kind of improvement in Indigenous employment, and they kind of fell away a little bit during the global financial crisis. So you can almost see like the counter argument is that, well, who are some of the population groups which are most likely to be impacted by a kind of financial crisis? Well, one would be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have less experience in the labour market, more likely to be discriminated against, less likely to live in kind of areas with highly functioning labour markets. So what's one role of the voice? Well, one role of the voice is to argue to government how to manage that and how to set up a policy situation where those who are most impacted are protected the most. So I think that kind of walk and chew gum argument doesn't really hold.
But Inti, this is that whole thing about, you know, politics and political messaging and, you know, it's the kind of weaponization of these sorts of things. So we know that voters like to hear their plight talked about by politicians.
Absolutely.
And so the argument that your government is not looking after you, you're doing it tough out there in the suburbs or whatever it is, and your government's wondering, you know, prosecuting some sort of high-minded idea over here on something else.
Yeah.
And that means that they have stopped being interested in your concerns, your hardships, your grievances. And that's,
and so you might be punitive in whatever they're doing.
Well,
and
I mean, you know, they're not on the case for you, right? When absolutely. In fact, official policy official policy is what is, you know, what is driving up interest rates. It's the policy of the central bank to try and control inflation by having high interest rates. I mean, the government's not going to intervene in that or take a contrary position. But you can sort of see where the political potency of that kind of messaging is.
I really think that the Yes campaign can be really be hurt by the plight of Australians in terms of financial crisis. I was reading this paper this morning, actually, something about a news poll that shows that Albanese's support for Albanese's government went down, whereas support for coalition went up as the support for voice slumps, which I thought was quite interesting because is this argument where, you know, my government should be looking at, you know, these things I'm struggling with rather than a voice to Parliament, like why now? Why this? Right? So I wouldn't be surprised if the Yes campaign is hurt by this, because at the end of the day, in a referendum in Australia, everyone votes.
Yep.
And I think the decisive factor comes down to people who are not really sure or have a lot of information about the voice. And these people might not actually actively go and seek more information. They'd rather be like, why am I voting for this?
Or just simply that they are in a grumpy mood because of harsh circumstances. I mean, you know, no one's denying the circumstances are harsh. That's what your data shows, right?
Yeah, sure.
So grumpy voters can tend to be somewhat, you know, less inclined to take a punt on something or to think.
Undecided grumpy voters who don't know much about what the voice referendum is seeking to do.
And who are being told, celebrate your ignorance. Don't worry about it. If you don't know, vote no. You know, that's the,
yeah, absolutely.
That's the
message. I mean, I read something about, we don't know about what the body voice is going to do. You don't want Indigenous Australians to make decisions about submarines. So that kind of like scare campaign or and disinformation and misinformation going around, and I feel like these undecided voters are quite
I think what we can say about this, right, is that in the optimal circumstances you wouldn't be running a referendum in circumstances where people are under a lot of financial duress because, you know, obviously it's just not ideal. They're more inclined to be thinking about their immediate problems and perhaps being a bit resentful about other things. Whether that's reasonable or not sort of almost doesn't matter. It's just a fact.
Yeah, and I think it does also – it does create a challenge, obviously, for the Yes campaign. But challenges can be overcome as well. So
yeah,
I think
you would hope so.
So I think it's worth kind of keeping in mind that there are kind of counter arguments, as I said, which you can make, and having a kind of consistent message, partly about how the kind of issues are separate, partly about how the voice can kind of work under multiple circumstances, and how a voice is about managing policy outcomes to improve the lives of a group of Australians who are impacted by financial crises and other kind of negative economic circumstances. It's a harder argument to make. And you're right. I think if the Yes campaign or the Prime Minister was able to kind of sketch out the ideal circumstances, it wouldn't be now. But it's the circumstances he's in. So I think the challenge is, you know, mitigating some of those concerns, finding a way to articulate how a voice can work in multiple economic or different economic environments. And also, I think, nullifying some of the concerns about kind of the financial crisis and or the inflation crisis, I guess. And part of that is policies which can support people who are finding it difficult, ways in which the blunt instrument of interest rates is smoothed a little bit and doesn't kind of fall on one group disproportionately. And that's hard. That's a hard challenge, but that's why you go into politics, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. You're meant to manage these things, yeah. Mm. Okay, look, thanks so much for this discussion. It's been really interesting, and thanks for the research. It's very useful to give us a sense of where we are and to make us think about how these circumstances, policies and economic conditions and so forth, how they affect people differently how people view them, I guess, depending on what their own circumstances are, where they live and with whom they work and socialise and the like. So really, really fascinating, and keep it up.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. You've been listening to Nick Biddle and Intifar Chowdhury. We'll be back next week with something else. I don't know what it is yet, but stay tuned. Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.